Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar, Extending Care, Supporting Young People's Transition from Out-of-Home Care to Adulthood. My name's Stuart Muir, a Senior Research Fellow here at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Before we start today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we're meeting. In Melbourne, the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri and the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and to elders from other communities who may be participating today. Today's webinar will discuss recent research on the social and economic benefits of extending care to young people transitioning from out-of-home care into adulthood. And we're very privileged to have two eminent speakers to discuss this topic. We have Philip Mendez, Director of the Social Inclusion and Social Policy Research Unit in the Department of Social Work at Monash University, and Paul McDonald, CEO of Anglicare Victoria. Philip has been researching state care and transitions from care for over 20 years. He's the Australian representative on the Transitions to Adulthood for Young People, Leaving Public Care International Research Group, and has undertaken research on youth justice, employment and mentoring programs, disability and Indigenous care leavers, and is also currently leading a national study of Indigenous young people leaving care, which is funded by the Sydney Meyer Foundation. Please head to our website for information about the range of publications that Philip's authored on these subjects. Joining Philip is Paul McDonald. Paul will be drawing on his extensive experience leading numerous government and non-government social welfare initiatives to improve outcomes for young people. In addition to his role for Anglicare Victoria, Paul is president of the Centre for Excellence in Child and Family Welfare, was recently appointed state chair of the reform of the out-of-home care system for the Victorian government, and is chair of the Home Stretch campaign. During the webinar today, we encourage you to send your questions throughout for Philip and Paul to answer during our Q&A session at the end of today's presentation. Those questions we can't get to during the session will be posted and answered in the online forum following this presentation. Please let us know if you don't want your question published on the online forum. As always, our webinars are recorded, the slides are available in the handout section of the GoToWebinar, and the audio, slides, transcript and recording of the webinar will also be available on our website in the coming week. So I'd now like to hand over to Philip Mendez, and please everyone give him a warm virtual welcome.
Thank you, Stuart. So young people transitioning from out-of-home care, often called care leavers or care experienced young people, are universally a vulnerable group who have generally not received the ongoing and holistic support that they require to transition successfully into adult life. Now, leaving care is formally defined as the end of legal responsibility by the state for young people living in out-of-home care, which generally occurs at no later than 18 years of age. And care leavers generally experience accelerated and compressed transitions to adulthood. And as a consequence, they often face significant barriers to accessing educational, employment, housing, health, and other developmental and transitional pathways and opportunities that are readily available to their non-care peers in the general community. Now, historically, most countries have provided only limited leaving care or post-care support services. But over the last two decades, there has been growing international awareness of the needs of care leavers and an expectation of ongoing care beyond 18 years of age. Consequently, most of the countries in the OECD and many other jurisdictions have introduced new legislation or expanded existing laws, policies or programs to assist this group of young people. Now, that upgraded assistance seems to reflect an increasing recognition that if the invasive state intervention into families by child protection systems is to be justified, then governments have both the moral and the legal obligation to devote sufficient resources to ensure that the outcomes for these rescued children are better than if they had remained with their family of origin. So in this webinar, we're specifically going to look at some of the extended care reforms in both England and the USA. England introduced the Children Leaving Care Act 2000 in October 2001, which was followed by similar legislation in Northern Ireland and Scotland. That act was intended, quote, to improve the life chances of young people living in and leaving care, quote unquote, and to replicate the supports that responsible parents would be expected to provide for their children. It extended the expected age of leaving care from 16 to 18 years and obliged local authorities to continue to provide advice and support for care leavers up to the age of 21 and even to 24 years for those still in education and training. In short, the intention was to delay the transition from care until young people were both prepared and ready to leave. So the Act introduced an expectation of corporate parenting responsibility to provide ongoing support to care leavers in order to promote better outcomes. So overall, the Act significantly extended the duties and powers of the earlier Children Act in England, and local authorities throughout England were then obliged to assess the needs of all young people in care and required to develop a pathway plan at the age of 16 years to meet those needs and provide a clear road to independence. Furthermore, the authorities had to arrange for care leavers to have a personal advisor until they were 21 years of age, who would coordinate the services required to meet the pathway plan. Now, that new act in England produced a mixture of positive and negative results. So, on the one hand, there appeared to be an increased number of young people in further education and a reduction in the numbers of those care leavers not in education, training or employment. In addition, there seemed to be gains in accommodation, financial support, improvements in life skills, and development of social networks and staffing for leaving care services. On the other hand, there were still problems in areas like resources, planning, availability, and provision of health services. There arguably remain too many young people still not in education, employment, or training, a lack of specialist supports for young people with a disability and those with mental health or emotional or behavioural difficulties, and a lack of suitable accommodation. So one key policy response to those concerns was the introduction of a form of extended care in England known as the Staying Put Programme, which was introduced as a pilot from 2008 to 11 in 11 local authorities and then legislated as an ongoing duty on all local authorities in England from May 2014 in the Children and Families Act 2014. So that act required local authorities in England to facilitate, monitor and support staying put arrangements for fostered young people until they reach the age of 21, where this is what they and their foster carers want, unless the local authority considers that the staying put arrangement is not consistent with the welfare of the young person. Now, Emily Munro, who is now at the University of Bedfordshire, and her colleagues completed an evaluation of the staying put trial in 2012, and they used a range of mixed methods in their evaluation. What they found were systemic benefits of the staying put extended foster care program, including the following: stable and supportive relationships, providing ongoing emotional support to young people who are not developmentally ready for adulthood at 18 years, and housing and associated stability, which facilitates engagement in education, employment and training, and enables young people to undertake a gradual transition that mirrors the pathways of their peers in the general population. Specific positive outcomes included greater housing stability and higher engagement in educational training and employment, including greater access to higher education, which should lead to higher future earnings and less reliance on public benefits. Now, to date, there has been no formal evaluation of the ongoing Staying Put program. But informal reports from researchers and policy advocates in England emphasise the importance of the duties being backed up by adequate resources to ensure sufficient information is available to young people and foster carers, plus consistency of service delivery across all regions to facilitate access to the option of staying put. And then there is the USA. So the USA introduced the Foster Care Independence Act in December 1999, which expanded room and board for young care leavers aged 18 to 20 years, expanded access to Medicaid for care leavers, provided additional funds for education and training, and increased state accountability for care leaver outcomes. The Act was a significant improvement at that time in terms of offering greater support to meet care leavers' needs around access to housing, health services, in particular mental health services, and education and training. However, research revealed that funding remained inadequate to meet the needs of most care leavers. Take up by states in regards to healthcare was discretionary, and optimal implementation of that act depended on their willingness in states to match federal funds with required levels of individual state funding. Consequently, the USA enacted the Fostering Connections Act in 2008 as a form of extended care, which aimed to extend the Foster Care Independence Act by giving states the option of maintaining young people in foster care until 21 years of age. There is a requirement to be eligible that young people are completing secondary school or equivalent, or enrolled in post-secondary or vocational school, or participating in a program or activity that promotes or removes barriers to employment, or are employed 80 hours a month, or alternatively are incapable of school and or work requirements due to a documented medical condition or disability. By early 2017, nearly half of all American states had taken up this option of extending care till 21 with federal financial support. Now, Professor Mark Courtney, a leading researcher in America, and his colleagues in California used a number of mixed methods in their evaluation of extended care in California. And they were able to report specific benefits of extended care, such as the following: enhanced educational outcomes, improved earnings and less economic hardship, fewer earlier pregnancies, lower levels of homelessness, reduced mental health difficulties or involvement in the criminal justice system, and greater involvement of non-custodial fathers with their children. Additionally, the New Zealand-based researcher Ian Matheson completed a mapping exercise of the international evidence base for extended care last year. He used a number of methods and was able to cite evidence of consistent positive outcomes in education, reduced criminal justice involvement, housing stability, and more positive transitioning overall. However, he concluded that the results concerning earnings, delayed pregnancies, and engagement with training and employment seemed to be more varied. Now, Ian Matheson argues that extended care works for a number of clear reasons: because it offers continuity and stability to young people, a nurturing environment, it helps engagement in education, employment and training, it empowers young people, and it gives them greater choice and control over the timing and the process of their transition. He notes that outcomes can be fluid depending on a range of factors, including whether extended care is offered universally to all care leavers or not, whether it includes residential care or not, whether it allows those who left earlier than 18 years to return before they turn 21, and whether or not it includes strict conditions like full-time involvement in education, employment and training. Effectiveness may also vary across different political regimes and cultures in different countries. So he recommends a strong co-design or co-production approach and an evaluative approach for optimal outcomes. So to conclude briefly with lessons for Australia, remembering that both England and the USA have very different health and welfare systems to Australia, but nevertheless, the evidence does suggest that extended care in Australia should lead to improvements in the key areas like education and employment, housing, health, and reduced involvement in offending and criminal justice. But we need to remember that effective implementation requires one, detailed planning, two, sufficient funding, and three, ongoing monitoring and evaluation.
Okay, so hello everyone, great to be with you on this AFES webinar. I'm Paul McDonald, Chair of the Homestretch Movement and also CEO of Anglicare Victoria. I'm going to talk to you about the extended care reform progress and debate that's been going on in Australia and how jurisdictions are faring in each of those on their activities and consideration for implementing extended care as very much what we've seen internationally here in Australia. The way to maybe I thought I'd kick off is show you a short video just for 2 minutes, and it's just to summarise the issues around extended care, how young people suffer, I'd have to say, in such sort of direct terms, when care is terminated at 18, as is evident in most jurisdictions around Australia. Now, just on the video, folks, if the video doesn't play, I request you to stay with us. It only goes for a couple of minutes, and then we'll resume the webinar. Your internet or systems may struggle, though it is... and we apologise for any inconvenience if that is the case. What AFES will also do, though, is they'll put the video up on the Child Family Community Australia website or CFCA, so you can access it there as well. So I might turn to my team of technical colleagues, and they're going to press the button, and let's see how we go. Okay, well, hopefully... a number of you or many of you just got a sense of that video. If you didn't get a sense, I'm going to walk you through the case anyway, so you haven't missed anything. And you can also find that video up on YouTube. Where I thought I'd go first is what is out-of-home care? And basically, out-of-home care, it refers to statutory care of children and young people who are unable to live with their parents. So children out-of-home care are in most cases also on a care and protection order. They may have been removed due to... abuse, neglect or relinquishment reasons. There are around 40, well, you know, depending on the latest stats, and I'm certainly here in the building of AFES, so I think there'd be upgraded stats here, but let's say there's around 50,000 young people who are in out-of-home care. Most of those are in foster care and kinship care, with around 5 to 6% who are in also residential care. And about a third of those, a bit over a third, are children of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander descent. So, in a sense, when we're thinking about this target group, and I'm talking to you about the target group between 15 and 17 years, when the state normally sets about the process of exiting or terminating care. When you look across Australia, there's around, in jurisdictional terms, nationally, there's 3,000 young people who will be exiting between 15 and 17 every year from state care. And hopefully you can see the slide of the breakdown of the different states in relation to how many from each state that are exited. But every year, around 3,000 are exited. Now, if what we do know about this target group, and there's been many centimetres of research, I'd have to say, here in Australia, that talk about the outcomes for children, young people, when they do leave care. What we do know, and you might have noticed Swinburne University Technology back in 2015, who did their national survey of homeless youth, found that 63% of them were actually in state care historically and were now homeless. When you have a look at some of the other outcomes, 35% had five or more places of stay in their first 12 months from leaving care. Just under 30% were unemployed. Many of them were new parents. And also many, particularly the young men, just around 40-odd percent, had been involved in the juvenile justice system. Again, within the first 12 months of the care being terminated. And what we do know, and what's great to do this webinar with you in AIFS, it was yesterday the Australian Institute of Family Studies, you might have seen it, released a report about how young people are remaining in the family home for longer. Now there's some, I think it's 43%, the AIFS report announced yesterday, of 20 to 24-year-olds, up from 36%, are still in the family home. Goodness me, 17% of 25 to 29-year-olds are still in the family home. Yet, in every state in Australia, legislatively speaking, care is to be terminated, ended, without discretion, without any discussion, at 18. Now, what does this in fact mean? Well, their work is removed, or legal, physical, domestic support is then terminated, and they're required to fend for themselves. There may be, in different states that you may be occupying, some leaving care programs, but the important point here is that the care is terminated. It is not disrupted, terminated. So it finishes, has to continue in some other guise. So what we've seen is West Australia, South Australia, Tasmania, Victoria, ACT, New South Wales, Queensland and Northern Territory all universally have their legislation that care is to be finished at 18, and all universally have their care planning requirements are required to begin with a child at 15. Now, can you imagine going up to your own child at 15 and saying, oh, by the way, Johnny, it's we've got to get you a leaving care plan. This is what the state does to children in state care, requires them to have a care leaving plan at 15. Now, really, as we know as parents, as we know raising children ourselves, or even corporately, what I mean by that, of raising children in the care system, we know they're not ready to go at 18. So Homestretch argues, why don't we provide the option for the care placement to continue past 18 through to 21 to guarantee that? And in fact, actually, build that in when they're doing their leave care planning at 15 to ensure that there's certainty and continuity. We know, and Phil's just very eloquently described the international progress where care is extended, 46 states in the United States, so it's virtually across the country there. We have England also implemented to 21 years. So it's interesting when you go to the States, folks. You go to the States and say, how's this foster care system going through to, the extended through to 21? And they say, what do you mean? Foster care is through to 21. Foster care is 21. So it's actually very much in their DNA that care does not finish up until 21. Yet we continue in Australia to have an artificial, dated, backward-thinking, non-contemporary parent way of looking at children in state care. And what we're saying is that it's time for Australia to catch up with the rest of the world. So the next slide that I'm showing you on your screen at the moment are the evaluations that Phil mentioned and referred to, but just specifically on number terms, the reports have shown that's halved the homeless rate for this cohort, halved it by 50%, doubled the education participation rate of this cohort, 38% of reductions in youth pregnancies. Encourage you to have a look at the Cal Youth study, which is the Courtney study on extended care in California, reduced arrests by 54%. So compelling stats. So what we went on and looking at in relation to child and family welfare reform was considered in the UK by Amanda Cumberland, who was the parliamentary advisor at the time, was the most significant child welfare reform in the United Kingdom. Well, we want to get a piece of that here in Australia, don't we, folks? So what we decided to do was that We went to Deloitte Access Economics, and we asked them, could they do a similar cost-benefit study, state by state, and imagine if care was extended to 21, what would be the benefits? What would be the outcomes? What would be the costs to the state? Are there, in fact, actually economic as well as social outcomes that that can be delivered? What's interesting here on the next slide, which I'm talking about, the current financial impact, it's not only the state and territory that have to do some fairly significant costs when we terminate care at 18, and I'll show you those in a tick. It's $600 million. But it's interestingly the Commonwealth, who does not have jurisdiction over child welfare here in this country, they're paying $1.8 billion over the next 10 years if we continue to have care terminated at 18. That being costs in Centrelink payments, costs in due to early pregnancies, costs in hospitalisation, you know. So Deloitte Access Economics has found that if we do not extend care through to 21, the costs to the country will be $2.4 billion. $1.8 billion, the Commonwealth are picking up the cheque, and $0.6 billion or $600 million for the state and territory. So Deloitte and Access Economics said, on a cost-benefit ratio, if we did implement extended care, that is, if we allowed the placement to continue through to 21, and on current figures, and this is on current figures, if around 30% of children who were in care took up the option. Now remember, I'll just detour here a little bit. We're not arguing or suggesting that every child in state care should continue on to 21. Many will choose their own path. Many will say, great, I can't wait to get out of here, and bang, off they go. But for those who aren't ready, or for those, you know, 7 months pregnant, those who got caught next week, those hopelessly unemployed, those on the spectrum order, those who are very well adjusted but aren't very independently ready, for all of those, could we allow that option for them to remain? Now, Deloitte Access Economics, on the economic argument, said that in fact there's a cost-benefit return. There's a return on every $1. If a government invested $1 into extending care, their return will be, well, New South Wales, $3.40, Queensland, $2.69, Tasmania, $2.69, as the list goes on. It's all there in front of you. So there's a return on investment for government. So not only is this producing good social return, but it's producing good economic return for state governments. And on the social return, Deloitte Access Economics said, if we did what the states, what the UK, what New Zealand are planning to do, then measured against homelessness rates, we'll see reductions in teen pregnancy from 16% to 10.2%, homelessness reduction for this cohort from 39% to 19.5%. I mean, hospitalisation reduced from 29% to 19%, so there's about a third there. Interaction with the criminal justice reduced again by around a third. Mental illness reduced. Interestingly, such a focus of this election campaign. Mental illness reduced very significantly, and so on and so forth. So it's a simple reform with social outcomes and proof and evidence of social returns that are really giants in the social policy area for outcomes. Now, how could this work? How would we do this? Well, just briefly, how we do it, a likely pathway is that if a child is in foster or kinship placement, in their current placement, and if the carer and the child said, yes, let's remain together, then the placement would continue. Or if the child in foster and kinship said, look, I've really enjoyed being with my foster and kinship placement, but I'd like to go out on my own in some sort of supervised sort of arrangement, or if one was in residential or lead tenant placement, they'd also move into a guaranteed supervised independent living arrangement. And I can talk a little bit about how some states are thinking about doing that in a tick. And those who have left care, that is those who have gone and said, no, stuff it, I'm out of here, can't wait, and then have fallen, as many of I've seen and many of you have seen, falling into homeless shelters within 3 to 4 months of ill-thought-through plans, we'd bring them back too, just like our own kids who have gone out, had a go, and then said, Mum, Dad, can I come back? Just like that, we'd have a care system saying, yes, we cared for you for 17 years. I know you're trying, didn't work out? Okay, come back into this model, and we'll get you up and started. Now, in relation to the reimbursement,